The next half hour brings us segments from the third annual bilingual conference that was recently held in Anchorage. I'm Mo Wasley, and welcome to Potlatch. Catherine Hurley begins by advocating pride in individuality and cooperation in bilingual education.
To me, the exciting result of the emphasis on bilingual bicultural education is the involvement of parents and the community in the development of the curriculum and the use of qualified experts to teach. And then there is the magnificent reward in which we all can share, the preservation of the many cultures which are a part of our heritage through art, music, dance, writing, oral history, etc. In order to make bilingual bicultural education succeed, we need the fullest cooperation. So let us not be concerned about who is running the program, but that the program exists. Not who gets the credit for developing a program, but that the best program evolves through all of us working together. There are many forces eager to break down the respect we have for each other's talents. But if we put what is best for children first, this won't happen. Having been born in Alaska and having raised my children here, I want everyone to have the feeling of pride that I have in being an Alaskan. And I want Alaska to be known as a place where the individual matters. And encouraging and fostering any program which makes it possible for every child to be proud of who he or she is certainly going to help us fight those who may wish to destroy individual rights.
That was Catherine Hurley. Retired Native Judge Nora Gwynn from Bethel describes the role she played in bilingual education and talked about the importance in keeping lines of communication open between Alaskans.
I'm assuming that every single one of you here are doing your part in education for our children and ourselves. Education never ceases. It just never quits. Whether it's formal or informal, you're continually learning something, and you're learning something about one another. That is one of the most important things there is, to begin to communicate. I'd like to see every person in Alaska, when they pass one another, nod their head a little bit, instead of just walking on past like they do in the States, you know, recognizing another Alaskan. I think, getting down real serious now, my part with this bilingual program has been in the court system. As the first and only Native judge, and the only first and only lady judge, let's say, not always so gentle, my part in this program has been really hard. We have no words in our native language that is just one word for justice. We have no word that means guilty. We have no word that says not guilty, so we use other words. We use, is it true or is it not true? That's the best we can do. I've held court in small villages in my language, and I speak the entire Kuskokwim Yukon dialect. I'm understood, and I understand them, which is the main thing. I want to encourage all of you, learn your language, learn your English, and become experts. You can do it, and you can keep learning. It doesn't matter what age you are, you learn and communicate.
That was retired Judge Nora Gwynn. William Leap, who's a lawyer from the Lower 48 and who's worked with Indian tribes, spoke about the impact of Alaska's efforts in bilingual education there and what some tribes are doing in determining their own programs.
The Ponkas have been studied by anthropologists. Remember anthropologists? I have been studied by linguists, remember linguists, for about 50 or 60 years. and they never got an alphabet, a writing system for their language until now. And it took the efforts of some tribal people going to the Indian Affairs Commission in the state to get some technical assistance, because the linguists that had been working with them had not put out in this fashion. Oh, some of you people in Alaska are very, very lucky in terms of the kind of linguistic support services you're receiving. But this is the whole point of what's going on down there. Communities that didn't receive services before are beginning to receive them. There's legislation in Montana that says anyone who teaches in an Indian school must prove that they know something about Indian people. They must have at least 12 hours of coursework, and it's not meant sort of peripheral coursework about Indians, but substantive things, so the teachers will know something about their students. New Mexico is going to set up a Department of Indian Education that's parallel to their State Department of Education, not subordinate to it, but parallel to it. It's going to be staffed by Indian people, and it's going to deal with all Indian educational needs, kindergarten through college level. That's where New Mexico is at in terms of its long-range planning. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs, remember the BIA? They, in response to a lot of this, are seriously implementing now possibilities of direct funding, line budgeting, right out of Washington, directly into local BIA schools, bypassing all area and agency authorities and officers. And with this comes their new proposal to implement bilingual education in all schools where and as appropriate. The only obstacle is a familiar one to many of you, funding. But at present time, Bill Dimmert is in the process of trying to convince Congress that since Congress now knows that the Bureau is not working as effectively as it should, Congress should act in a typically congressional way to help the Bureau do what its mandate says it should do, that typical way being granting funds. You have no idea the impact you people had nationally when the Alaska Native Language Center was formed. The fact that state government would put state money into such a center produced real precedent and ammunition for people further south. In many ways, Alaska has become and is becoming a test case for a lot of issues in program development for Indian and Native peoples. The training that bilingual school programs give to community members is not only linguistic and cultural training, but it's political training. And that political training has tremendous possibilities of impact in the long run for Indian affairs and Native affairs in this country.
There's a place I can get to where I'm safe from the city blues, and it's green and it's quiet. Only trouble was I had to buy it, and I'll do anything I got to do. Cut my hair and shine my shoes and keep on singing the blues if I can stay here in Johnny's garden. The swift bird flies over the grasses, dipping now and then to take his breakfast. Thus I come and go, and I travel, but I can watch that bird and unravel, and I'll do anything I got to do. Cut my hair and shine my shoes, keep on singing the blues if I can stay here in Johnny's garden. With his love and his caring, he puts his life into beauty sharing. And his children they give me peace in quiet hours, and I'll do anything I got to do, cut my hair and shine my shoes, and keep on singing the blues if I can stay here in Johnny's garden.
Stephen Stills. Dr. Walter Soboloff at Tenakee Springs told how his mother taught her brother to read and write English. He started by giving a background of education in relation to the native people.
It seems that education in that early day was not the pattern for our people. It was out of place because we were hunters, we were fishermen. We didn't have to go to a store to get what we needed to eat and what we needed to wear. We were like a big company to ourselves, and we got along. The learned part of the United States of America was already going strong, and here we were, just beginning. And in the American world, there are types of education. I'd like to cite three. But we had the first two, number one. This one they call milieu. It's a new word to me, too. It means the customary way of doing things in a particular culture. The byproducts of ordinary living. We always did it this way. And so our grandparents, our uncles, our mother, our father did things, and we copied them. And they tell us, this is the way you do it. And we never ask, this is the way we did it. And we say in the Tlingit language, listen to your grandparents, listen to your uncle. And we listen, and we did the things they did and the way they did it. And the second is the informal. Parents share a great deal of this learning of oral tradition. The parents were the first teachers among us. And in the Caucasian world, they also say this. The parents, the fathers and mothers, are the first teachers of the children. In the Caucasian world, it is true in our world. Athabascan, Eskimo, Aleut, name all the people. Our parents were our first teachers. And then the third came the formal education. My uncle was number one hooky man. He was always playing hooky from school. Well, it is a new thing. But he learned to play hooky real fast. And so my mother, when my grandfather and grandmother died, my mother's aunts took them in, real Tlingit people, no school whatsoever. My mother remembered her 3 years of schooling. And so in our culture, it wasn't right for a sister to talk to her brother. It wasn't good manners. Neither was it good manners for a brother to talk to his sister, teenage people. But for some reason, in my family, this was excused. And my mother was teaching my uncle, John Hunter, how to write his name, and how to spell, and how to read. He couldn't go hooky anymore. His sister was his teacher, my mother. And what happened, you know? He started to buy books on mechanical engineering, diesel engineering. And I think he was one of the first Tlingit Indians in Southeast Alaska to get his license to operate diesel engineering. And my mother was his professor.
Dr. Sobolov continues on to describe how the native groups accepted the educational system and the revitalization of Alaska Native culture.
Throughout history, when a society is threatened with destruction of its way of life, revitalization movements are bound to rise. That is to say, something comes among the people in groups or one group to say, we got to keep this thing alive. It has to keep moving. We can't let our culture die. And so we organize a dancing club, a singing club, a sewing club. And this is good. And I think it's happening in Alaska. Fortunately, we in Alaska have not gone through a political war to build a modern state. Whereas in other parts of the world, such as Africa, you read in the paper today, Africa is struggling. African people are fighting for their rights to be alive, to be recognized, and it isn't settled yet. Many lives are being lost in the literal battle for a survival of that culture. But we in Alaska have been very, very fortunate. We haven't had to go through that kind of a revolution. It was not necessary to nationalize us. We who have accepted the American way of life, its form of government, initially through the school system. The new concept of education was superimposed over and above the native culture without our permission. They didn't ask us, we just accepted. Probably due to our nature of being non-resistant. We just didn't want to buck the new order. We just took it. A new person came to our village, we took him in. A new boat anchored along my village shore. We didn't chase them away. We just accepted them, and so we did of education. It was like installing a motor in a canoe built only to be paddled. Basically, the native Alaskan was always known for his accommodation. We always are always friendly. Well, sometimes we had battles, of course, but generally we were friendly people. Little by little, or gradually, patient and understanding church missionaries were advising natives about the eventual benefits of education. We didn't quite understand. Well, when I was going to college, my own people said to me, Walter, stay home now. My mother said, Walter, get married now. I was a bachelor yet, you know. Get married. They didn't encourage me to go on to college because they were in another world. And I don't hold it against them. But I was just stubborn enough, you know, to go on to school. I remember one time when the CC work came to Southeast Alaska, and I was almost getting married, but I was broke. And then I asked myself, what can I do to support a family, to support children? I couldn't do anything. And perhaps I made a good escape to college. It reminds me of a story of a fellow who was thinking of getting married. And he had fished in the summer and made a few dollars, maybe $150, and that is a lot of money. And he was also engaged to be married. And he was a musician. He could play a trombone, and he was trying to decide, should I get married or should I buy a trombone? Lest you wonder, he bought a trombone.
Well, my name, it ain't nothing, and I come from Maine. And I love the rabbits and I love the rain. And I've been to China and I've been to Spain. And I never learned nothing at all, except there ain't no time for the worrying blues. It's a again. Well, my name it ain't nothing, and I come from Mars, and I love macaroni, and I love the stars, and I love to float, and I love to fly, and I love to see you smile. And if I had a hammer and a bunch of nails, I'd build myself a little fairy tale. And if I had a castle in this world, I'd graded it on a puppy dog, yes I would. Now I'll never grow up, but I'll never grow down. It's a raggedy world that keeps spinning around. Don't sound like much, but I swear it's true that there ain't no time for the worrying blues, though there ain't.
Buffy St. Marie. Our final segment has Dr. Sobeloff talking about the need to provide first-rate facilities for Native students and the efforts of the church and school in assimilative acculturation.
As we have been moving from one culture to another, some interesting things have happened. In the first place, the church and the school, in some parts, not all, but the church and the school were so determined to walk away from our traditional way of life. They were trying to make us, shall I say, cowboys or regular American type people, you know, and walking away from the language, the arts, the dances, the culture, leading us away from this. And some of our people liked it. But all at once there came a change. All at once it seemed our people woke up. Like in 1940 in Southeast Alaska. I remember old Jack Gamble, a Thlinget from the Auk tribe. He had several trunks full of ceremonial dance blankets. And shakiat, this kind of hat Walter Williams is wearing over there. Button blankets, chilkat blankets in boxes. They were packed there for 30 and 40 years, some 50. And all at once it seems that no longer could Thlinget culture be put under the platform or in the ground or in the attic or in the basement. It started to come out. And we started to sing and we started to dance just for fun. And some of the old people who were walking around at canes, you know, they threw away their canes and they were dancing so hard that they forgot all about their aches and pains, and they next day they looked so much younger and happier. What happened? A people who had been mentally depressed, who couldn't accept the American way of life, excepting just buying the bread from the store and the sugar and the coffee and other things, that's all they were taking. But the culture was all wrapped up and tied up and put away. But now something new happened. There's a word for that in Thlinget, and I'd like to say it. It's called yeastasik, meaning a new breath. Again, a new breath came among the people. Well, some of the things were really not good, you know. But in the white culture, the same is true. Some things in the white culture is not good, but they don't throw it away. So why should we throw ours away, you know? This revival was not too well received by educators, by church members and its leaders and the natives who were alienated from their rich heritage. Philosophically, if the native culture was so inferior, we would not have survived for some 20,000 years or more, and better yet, a few of us are here speaking our ancestral language and fairly in good health, much less for the wear and tear that goes along with acculturation or that goes along with people changing their way of life. And it's been hard for many of our people to change from the village life to the new way of living, which we are in today. It hasn't been easy. But I haven't heard people complain. I haven't heard people fighting it. We have accepted it. And some have perished along the way, literally died because of the change. In its infancy, our educational system was completely out of our hands. We had little or nothing to do with it. But I'm not crying about it. Up to this point, it was natural and acceptable. We weren't ready to take a part in it. Today, the pupil has returned to assume roles of responsibility. But there are not enough of all of you native peoples to really get in the stream of education. Your process of American type education was not comprehensive. It wasn't enough for a wholesome advancement of the native student of Alaska, namely the Eskimo, the Aleut, the Athabascan, and others. For an example, the educational adjustment in the main offices always served only on an emergency basis. We have a problem here in the educational system in Alaska. Okay, what shall we do? Okay, let's do what we can, but it was never the best. Students were sent thousands of miles away from home. Kansas, Oregon, Mount Edgecombe, Eklutna, Wrangell Institute, and today we're still in the boarding home program. Emergency, always emergency. Yes, better than nothing, but still emergency. Unfortunately, the best or adequate facility was never available, but we accepted, among others, a Navy base, Mount Edgecombe, for school, which to begin with was designed for war and not education. But we were happy to get it. But I'm trying to say, you know, the things that happened among our people in the educational process. We always were so glad to accept third and fourth class type of facilities. The one-time educational experience of our youth must continually be guarded with a proviso that adequate facilities will be available with teachers of academic standing and good repute. Good teachers, good character, honest. Sometimes as they teach, they might be doing other things, teaching good things, but yet their character is telling us something else. And we need good examples for our boys and girls. And that schools be no longer accepted hundreds and thousands of miles away from home. It is my opinion our native children and parents have suffered needlessly, and many have not come to their defense. However, in my case, I was at least so close to a school during the fourth grade in Killisloo when it was my turn to wash dishes. I threw the dishwater on the red schoolhouse wall. Maybe that's why I'm such a success or a failure today, I don't know.
Listening to the music of Leo Kottke. I'd like to remind the people that are listening out in our listening area that if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about the programming for Potlatch, why don't you drop us a line at KUAC Fairbanks, Alaska 99701. Just drop us a line to Potlatch, care of KUAC Fairbanks, Alaska 99701. I'm Mo Wasley, and thank you for listening.
Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.